Hello, hello from London to all of you. For those of you who don't know, my name is Ekaterina. I'm co-founder of Future London Academy. For those of you who haven't heard of Future London Academy before, we are an executive school for creatives. So we do lots of incredible things, including courses, events, and wonderful podcasts like this for senior creative community. So check us out. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, wherever you listen to or get information from. And make sure you get inspired, connect with people, because this is what we believe in. Now, to the topic of today's conversation, because today we are doing our founders series and growth series. And today we have a very special guest with us, Steve Bell. Steve Bell, a lot of you might know as a co-founder of Iris, the advertising agency that he co-founded in 1999. So he spent almost 25 years running this agency as a CEO and grew it to the global international success with 14 or 15 offices across the world and over 1,000 people working in a company. That's absolutely mad. And now, even more surprising, what Steve did, he actually left Iris to become a CEO of a different company, Team 17, a gaming and game development company that is, again, incredibly inspiring and fascinating and completely different challenge for Steve. And we will talk about both today. First of all, how to grow your agency to the scale and the size and the success that Steve managed to do together with his co-founders, partners, and teams. But also, when is the time to step down as a CEO and maybe leave your company as a founder and maybe start a new journey? And what does it mean to become a CEO of a different company that you didn't found? So both of these things we will discuss today, and prepare your questions, because at the end, we'll take all of your questions as well. So welcome, Steve. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm totally energized by your introduction.
Yay, that's what we're going for.
The most intro I've ever had on any podcast I've been on. So it's a good start, isn't it?
Definitely a good start. And it's a start for a good conversation as well. I was just telling you now that I have so many questions for you. Seriously, I admire so much what you've done and achieved. And knowing you, you are so relaxed at all times that I seriously don't know how you do it. I cannot even imagine running a company of 1,000 people and still be smiling and friendly and so positive as you are. So I need to find out your secret today, and we'll talk about all of the stories that maybe actually were challenging, but you found the way out of them. But would love to start with rapid fire questions. So I have 10 very simple questions for you, and you can answer the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
I'm 100% ready. And I just want to tell everybody, I haven't seen these questions before. I have been on certain podcasts or interview where they give you the questions beforehand. So these are completely fresh. So I'll apologize now if any of my answers are pretty weak, but let's give it a go.
Do not worry. It's all about being in the moment. There is no best answer for sure. So Steve, describe yourself in 3 words.
I would say I'm passionate about whatever I do. I'm relatively humble about what is the things that are important and what I've achieved. I think you need to have a degree of humility about what you do. And I'm very, I'm family centric. So my family are by far the most important thing about what I do and why I do it. So yeah, that's the 3 things I'd say.
What do you do to relax from work?
Sport. I absolutely love sport. I love watching it. I love doing it. I run regularly. I play golf on a regular basis. I still play football. So yeah, sport is my switch off from everything that goes on from a corporate life.
That's a lot of different sports. Love it. Working from home or coming to the office?
I'm a true believer of a blend of both of those things. I think anybody in the world of advertising or marketing communications that spends all of their time at home is just missing out on some of the fun, the interaction, and the cultural development that I think is critical within a business. On the flip side, I think there are times when working from home is a really good thing, because you can lock yourself away. And when you get to a certain level of seniority within a business, your time is not your time. So you go from one side of the office to the other side of the office. I can guarantee there will be 3 or 4 people that want what they will classify as 2 minutes with you. And it will always be 15. So you almost need to build, and this sounds ridiculous, you build 20 minutes in your diary to get from one side to the other side of the office, just because you know that that's going to take the time for people to engage in you and just want to get some time with you, which is a really important thing to never underestimate. If you're a junior person and the CEO even chats to you when you're making a cup of tea in the kitchen or asks how you're doing, if you take yourself back 20 years, that almost makes your day if you're an account executive or a junior creative. So you can never, ever lose sight of the influence and power that a very small social interaction can have in the office.
Love this answer. That was much deeper than I expected, but that's a brilliant, brilliant answer. Thank you. Your favorite place in London?
My favorite place in London. I like Soho. I really do. And I was in Soho the other day and it just felt alive. It feels a bit raw, but I like that. But it feels alive whenever you're there, whether it's 10 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock at night. I think you're always going to get something that is quite culturally rich.
Professional achievement you are the most proud of?
It's setting Iris up. You tend to get one chance really to do something of that significance in your career. Some people might have a second roll of the dice, and we'll go on to talk about what I'm now doing and the decision that I made, which was a difficult one. But Iris, without a shadow of a doubt, I'll always look at that business with huge amounts of fondness and positive memories.
Brilliant. Company size you enjoyed running the most?
I would say between 80 and 100 people. It almost felt the optimum size for marketing communications anyway, because you don't have to rely too heavily on process, but you need some degree of process. You tend to know everybody pretty well within the business, so you've got a good understanding and you're all pulling in the same direction. And I think it feels like an extended, and I hate to use the word family, but it does. It feels like an extended family where you're not necessarily going to get on with everybody, but it feels as though it's an optimum size for a business in the world of marketing communications.
What time do you usually start your workday?
Pretty early, about 7:30 to 8 o'clock.
Nice. What time do you finish your workday?
Well, this is one of the problems, I would say, with working from home. The fact that the workday doesn't really end and it sort of drags into the evening and then you're constantly checking things. And I think especially when you have a global job, it's very difficult to switch off because you're always on. So when I was at Iris, I would always do my calls with Australia and Singapore in the morning, and then it would be the European offices during sort of lunchtime, and then I'll do North America later on in the afternoon and evening. So you need to be quite disciplined, because otherwise, you, without sounding ridiculous, you could be working 18-hour days because you're always needed by somebody within the business. So you have to be quite strict with yourself, otherwise you will burn out, and it's very easy to do when you're running a global business.
They say changing 9 to 5 to 24/7, that's the life of the founder. So sounds about right. Book that changed your mind on something?
I would say there is a book, it's an advertising book, and it's called Creative Minds. And I think it's by a guy called Andy Sutcliffe. I'm pretty certain it's by Andy Sutcliffe. And I read the book. It's quite an old book. It's probably about 25, 30 years old. And I read it, and it's about St. Luke's, the advertising agency. For somebody who was at university at the time, was quite uncertain as far as what I wanted to do with my career. I'd focused on marketing. I didn't know whether to be a client or whether I wanted to work in an agency. And I read the book, and it just spoke about the business and how they approach the people and how they approach their clients and everything like that. And it was literally a game changer for me. From the moment I read that book, I thought, I definitely want to run an agency one day, and was lucky enough to do that.
I love it. And I love St. Luke's, and I know the founders are incredible people there as well. So that is, I didn't know there was a book. So now I want to read it as well. I think I found it's called Creative Company, How St. Luke's Became the Ad Agency to End All Ad Agencies. So that's a lovely read that definitely will put in recommendation. Top quality that a CEO cannot survive without?
It is the phrase frustrated ambition. And what I mean by that, everybody that you talk to, or most people you talk to, will say, yeah, I'm ambitious. I'm really ambitious to be promoted or earn more money or to have a bigger team or whatever. But I think the best CEOs that I've ever seen and ever worked with have frustrated ambition, which means they want to do things quicker and better. And they're constantly looking for improvement. They're never ones to look back. They're always looking forward. So frustrated ambition is the trait that I would say is most critical for any senior leader or CEO.
That's a great advice. Thank you. One more. What is the best part about being a CEO?
I think the best part is the fact that if it's not working, if the business isn't working, then you have to do something about it. So you can't sit there and moan at, oh, she didn't do that, or they didn't do that, or they let me down there. You have to make things happen yourself. And I remember when I was quite junior in my career, and I spoke to my boss and I was like, I'm working every hour that I could possibly work and I can't do any more. And my diary is blocked from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. And my boss said to me, well, whose fault is that? You have to make change yourself. You can't be looking at other people to make changes when you get to a certain level of seniority. And I think that's the thing with a CEO. If things aren't working, you have to change it. And it's your responsibility and people look at you to make those changes. So I think that's a real blessing for anybody that gets to that level of seniority within a business. You have to take that responsibility and you have to do something about it.
Wow, another great answer, Steve. You're just such a wise human that I feel like rapid fire question could have become a book from just your answers. So thank you for sharing. And now we can slow down even more and go even deeper in all the things that you've done and all the things that you've reflected on. And we will probably go quite fast through the beginning stages. So when you got to this kind of 100 people size, and we'll go heavily on this growth from 100 to 100 to 1,000, because I think this is something very unique. Not a lot of us on this call have experience, so I feel like we could learn a lot from this phase. But to have a quick recap, as far as I know your story, your father worked in Duracell and kind of got you interested in this idea of marketing and product development. So that kind of led you to the path to study it, eventually to work in advertising, and eventually with few of your friends that you worked with in an advertising agency, you sat down, you thought of everything that was broken in advertising, and you decided that you want to start your own. From there on, your journey began with Iris. So was it 6 founders that started this journey together?
The interesting thing is we were friends through work. So it's not as if we were friends in terms of when we were growing up as children. We met each other in various agencies that we had worked in. And I worked within one of the big networked agencies. And yeah, we did exactly as you said. We sat down and said that there has to be a different way. It shouldn't be that difficult. The world of marketing communications, it's not as if you have to go out and spend £50 million on a plant with manufacturing machines and all the rest. It's just getting a few people that are engaged and motivated and feel as though they want to be doing the same thing. That's all the industry is from our perspective. So yeah, we grew very quickly, and you're right. I won't go into the early days because there's probably an hour's worth of stories just in terms of scrapping around and winning small clients and thinking we've made it, and then you lose that client and you go back. The interesting thing is when we got to 100, and we probably got to about 100 people within about 3 years, 3 or 4 years. So we grew pretty quickly. And then going back to this point around ambition, we had huge levels of ambition to be winning bigger clients and to be doing better work. And I think one of the things that was really, really interesting about our journey was it was never about getting rich quickly. It was never about making as much money as we possibly could. And that's not to say that money hasn't been important in the journey. But it was never the sole driver of doing what we did. And I think the minute you do have a business that is just chasing money rather than looking after culture and looking after the product that you actually create, then it will be a relatively short existence that business is around, because it has to be around your people and it has to be around your product. They're the two things that are most important, because if you can get those two things right and aligned, then the money will come. It will come as a byproduct of brilliant people chasing brilliant work. And that's just a really simple philosophy. And we used to call it the triangle of truth. And it was so simple, but it was always people and product, and profit was the third point of that triangle, but it was purposefully in that order. So that was a really important part of our growth. But as soon as we got to 100, we had huge amounts of confidence. We were attracting far bigger clients. Those clients were asking us if we could go international. They're asking us to do more things for them. So can you do a website for us? And it was at the time when web development and web creation, the dot-com boom was just about happening. So it was like, right, let's invest in that. Let's go to the best agencies in London and let's pick the best people from those best agencies and bring them in to work within Iris. So we never really wanted to just partner with other agencies. We always wanted to do it ourselves to have the control and the ability to invest in the right things. We then went international, which we always thought was important because clients were wanting us to work in various parts of the world. And then it just sort of literally snowballed from there. So more international offices, bigger clients, more internationalization of those clients. And then suddenly you're at 500 people. And then you acquire some businesses, and I'm making it sound very simple, and it's not. There's a huge amount of effort that goes into all of these things. But the ambition is the thing that drives it. Creating a culture that is strong is the foundation of any business. And then making sure that you are acquiring skills that it'll be very difficult for you to bring in yourself. Or if they're not too difficult to bring in yourself, then you can actually hire people within the business to grow certain practices. So that's almost a very quick 3-minute summary of how we took it from 100 to 1,000. I know we'll delve deeper into it because hopefully people are quite interested in it, but it gives you a flavour.
I love it. And yeah, if only it was as easy as you describe, you just do it in 3 minutes and suddenly goes from one number to another. Let's rewind back to the few things that you just said about this triangle and kind of picking the right clients and having the right culture and not chasing the money. I mean, in theory, it all sounds great. Now, what does it look in practice? And could you give a few examples of what when it worked, of like what does it look like when you had to say no to the client or you had to make maybe not so obvious decision that was more culture driven and team driven rather than money driven? And yeah, so any examples from that stage?
I think there's a few things about looking after people and the strength that culture brings with it, because what we realized very quickly in our existence is if you have equity, if you have part ownership of a business, you think and you feel and you act in a very different way to people who don't have ownership. And that sounds a really obvious thing to say. But when there's a few of you that own this business, and then there's more and more people that are joining the business thinking, well, we don't own it. You own it. So we can understand why you're working 16 hours a day, but we don't own it. Therefore, we feel slightly different about it. And sometimes we feel as though we're doing this just to try and make the individuals who founded the business very wealthy. And we realized that pretty quickly. And that didn't feel comfortable to us at all. So what we did is we diluted our offering, our equity, and made sure that other people who were key to the future growth of our business had equity in the business. And not 0.001% just to make them feel good, meaningful equity in our business. So when we sold our business, an earn out between 2015 and 2020, there were over 70 owners of the business. 70 people realized value from proper shares that they had. And that's quite unusual because usually within the world of advertising and marketing communications, the founders will keep 95% of the equity and they'll give a few token gestures of equity to people. But we didn't do that. So already you can see how the foundations of the business were born on meritocracy and making people feel as though they're part of something. Because if you're not part of that gang who have equity, it makes you feel on the outside, it makes you feel disappointed. It makes you feel as though you haven't got an opportunity to be part of it. So that's sort of one strategy that we went down as far as equity ownership. The other part is around working with the right sorts of clients. And I've always been a believer that you get the clients that you deserve. And that again sounds a pretty obvious thing to say. But if you're good people with a good cultural foundation to your business, you will attract really, really good people who, in terms of clients, people who really want to work with those people. Because working with an agency, if you're a client, working with an agency should be the best moment of the week. It should be the moment that you enjoy the most. You're talking about creativity and strategy and insight and a website, a TV ad, a digital marketing campaign. So if you're not making it feel like a really positive experience, I think you're going to fail. So we always have to think about that. And when I was at Iris, I said that time and time again, we've got to make the 2 hours that the client spends with us in any given week feel like the best moment of their week. So let's not forget that. And sometimes you do work with clients who you don't feel as though are treating you in the way that you should. So we had a client probably about 12 or 13 years ago. It was our second biggest client. And the amount of complaints we were getting internally in terms of they don't give us enough time, they don't give us the respect, they don't talk to us in the right way. We went to the client and said, we're not going to continue to work in this way. So you either change or we will have to resign the business, which made a massive difference to our commercial delivery of that particular year. The client said they would change. 3 months down the line, they didn't change. And I had to go in there and tell them that we're not going to continue working with them. The message of positivity that that sent to the entire agency, which is we're not going to let people treat us in a really bad way. And the feeling of confidence that people had in the business, the fact that we were willing to say, we're not going to work with that client, even though it means that we won't be paying bonus that year and people won't be realizing their bonus payments that they may have banked on. But that for me was more important than just carrying on and saying, oh, we'll try and change it. We'll try and change it. Sometimes you need to say, no, we are worth more than this, not from a financial perspective, but in terms of the way we treat our people. So there's two things there. One is around culture and ownership, and one is around what we believe is right and who we work with. And I think those two things brought together can make a pretty powerful business.
Well, thank you for sharing these examples. And what a brave decision to make to, first of all, to tell the client that you're unhappy with them as a client, that I don't know how many agencies even have guts to have this conversation, but also then to follow up with an action, which is, if you're not going to change, we are going to resign. And actually, to do that you're right, it's such a powerful message to the whole team. And especially, as you said, they were quite a significant client for the company. It must have been hard. And going back to having six founders, did all six founders agree on that? Or was it a controversial conversation?
It was an interesting one, because the thing about the multiple founder part, not all the founders have continued on the journey. A number of them have left for the right reasons. Some of them didn't want to work within a big agency network. They wanted to work in more of a boutique positioned agency. And that's fine. And we always wanted to set up the agency knowing that there will be a time for everybody to move on. And we never want to be slaves to the business that we've created, because you get one chance in terms of your career. And if you're not doing something that you're really enjoying and feeling that feeling at the end of the week, then something's not quite right there. So when we started the business out for the first 2 or 3 years, it was a disaster, because everybody had to be involved in every decision. So even to the extent, oh, what art do we have in the meeting rooms, or what do we call the meeting rooms, or what do we have for the lunches when a client comes in? And we felt the founders all have to be involved in that. And then very quickly we said, this is just not working. It's not making anybody happy. It's wholly inefficient, because we see need to sit down as founders all the time. So then we sort of said, right, okay, what we need to do is we need to have areas of responsibility that we have complete autonomy on. And then there will be certain decisions that we do need to get together, whether that's M&A or investment opportunities or whatever else there is that feels significant enough to be a decision about whether we work with a client or not from a moral perspective. So does that feel right for us to work on that client because they're a tobacco brand or an X brand or a Y brand? And so we would have those discussions, because I think that shouldn't be made by one person. But very quickly, within probably after a couple of years, we realized that there needed to be a degree of hierarchy amongst those partners, because the business needs that. And again, I've spoken to lots of CEOs who said, we've got a completely flat structure. There's no hierarchy at all. And I said, well, there is, because you're the CEO. So that already says there's hierarchy within your business. And then he or she will say, well, there's nothing underneath me. I said, but sometimes people need hierarchy to understand how a decision can and should be made. So sometimes some of these new age structural paradigms around how agencies work just don't tend to work in the way that people sometimes have the theoretical view they should. So no, not everybody was involved in every decision, fortunately, after a while.
Well, and I love that you brought up the founders dynamic, because you mentioned that you worked together previously, and I feel like it's so important when you pick a founder to actually know who they are in a work environment, because I think many times people start companies with friends that they haven't worked with, and they might be incredible people, but they have a completely different kind of work approach, and that becomes a tension. While you obviously seen each other, you know how each of you behaves, and therefore when things arise, you know how to resolve them, because again, you're all driven through their kind of professional lens. And I think it's good to hear that kind of, if you figure out your own areas, but you would come together to make the important decisions. Going to the important decisions. So we've got to this point in your story where you grew to, let's say, 100-ish time. So at which point you branched out to first international location? How did it happen? And was it an easy decision, or was it the one that you had to discuss and debate?
The first office that we set up outside of our London office was in Singapore. And it was opportunistic. It was a client said to us, if you had some people in Singapore, then we would give you significant amounts of business. So it wasn't even anything that we stopped to think about. It was more a case of, right, who can we put on a plane to get out there and set this office up? And there was a guy in the office who was an account director, a really talented account director. And we said, right, okay, why don't you go out to Singapore? And he's like, yeah, brilliant. I'm single. I don't have any responsibilities in London at all. I'm 28 years old, and I'll get out there. So the first Iris office was in a hotel room in Singapore, which it was there for about 3 or 4 weeks, and then we moved into a serviced office. The client was true to their word and gave us quite considerable amounts of business. We still have an office in Singapore of about 100 people, a really successful, creatively driven office that was born from the individual who we sent out there. He then became a partner, became the CEO of that office, and now he runs his own agency in London. So it's a brilliant story. But we spotted that he had that entrepreneurial spirit, was a really talented individual, and could take that on. But we always, whenever we created an office or set up an office organically within a part of the world, we would always send somebody from our London office who understood the DNA, understood what we were about, our processes and how we go about doing things, but also married them with somebody from the local market. So you could tap into the cultural idiosyncrasies of those markets, because I think it's quite naive. And so many British agencies have thought, well, we'll send a couple of Brits out to New York and it's going to be a great success. And these are brilliant agencies that are London-based, for example, and it doesn't work. You need to understand and respect the cultural differences within every single market. So we always had, whether it was the managing director was from London and had worked in an office, in the Iris office in London, and the creative director was from the local market, or the strategy director was from the local market, it was that marriage that created the strength of offering within those. So Singapore was our first office and is still a very successful office within the Iris network.
That's such a wonderful story. And well done for your colleague who, first of all, jumped on the opportunity and flew halfway across the world and created success in a different region, which I'm sure was not an easy ride. It still requires understanding all sorts of nuances. And obviously, you being so supportive and believing in someone, I'm sure meant a lot and supported the growth there. As far as I know the story, you kind of repeated that success in few areas before it suddenly became a bit too much. So tell us more, how did your global expansion go? And at which point it started breaking a little bit?
It was almost a case of whatever we touched turned to gold to start off with. It was, we were growing agencies around the world and we were winning clients and everything was as good as it possibly could be. And then we entered a competition, and it was a competition with one of the high street banks and one of the broadsheet newspapers in the UK. And basically it was an entrepreneurial competition. So it was like Dragon's Den. You'd have to go to a panel of four or five high net worth individuals who would suddenly look at your business. You would pitch an idea to them and they would say, yeah, you look like a really good business. So it was exactly like Dragon's Den or the Shark's Tank or whatever they call it in various parts of the world. So that was great. And what we actually won was a £5 million interest-free loan. So we won the entire thing. So we were the only company to win this because they looked at our growth track record and the clients we were attracting. So it was brilliant. But the word that we forgot very quickly was the word loan. And we just thought it was £5 million of free money. And what that enabled us to do was go and set up lots of different offices around the world, not really thinking about, have we got a client who can really warrant us spending money on setting this office up? Do we really have we done the due diligence in that market to work out what that market actually needs? Does it need another independent agency, or is it more of a market where the big networks, the WPPs and the Omnicoms and the IPGs, tend to have the lion's share? So it's quite interesting. So we're spending money like it's going out of fashion. And then suddenly the bank, so there's a banking crisis and the bank's like, right, okay, can we have that money back now? We're like, And it was probably the biggest wake-up call that we had as a business, because we realized we weren't really delivering the success that we thought we should have delivered. We weren't making money in the way that we were making money. It was a pretty tough wake-up call for the business, for us as founders, who had been almost untouchable for the years up until that point. Everything we were doing was hugely successful. So we closed a few of those offices down. We moved things around and then got back to the basics that we needed to. But it was probably the most significant lesson in my business career, because revenue and growth in revenue can hide a multitude of problems within a business. Because if your revenue is flying, what's going on underneath the revenue in terms of your cost control and where you're spending your money doesn't really matter that much, or you think it doesn't matter that much, because your revenue is sort of more than making up for it. And the minute your revenue starts to tail off, you look at a cost base that is increasing and then suddenly, well, we're not actually making any money now. So you suddenly have to wake up and you say, right, cost control is as important, if not more, than revenue growth. Because you need to know where you're spending your money. Are you getting value for money? Are you paying people too much? Are you bringing in too many people? Do we have too many people that aren't chargeable to clients? Because the whole thing about the world of advertising and marketing is you charge your clients for the hours that you're spending on your business. So if you've got too many people in legal teams and finance teams and HR teams and admin teams, you can't charge those people to clients. So suddenly our cost base was increasing and increasing based on lots of people that we couldn't charge out. And we had to get back to the basics of running a business that was reflective of the revenue that was coming in, rather than the £5 million interest-free loan that was suddenly called back by the bank. So hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah, wow. And that must have been hard. And again, you're talking about this with a smile and with very, very calm voice. But could we zoom in on that time? Because I wonder, what did it feel like? Were you scared at that point that you might not be able to, like, you might not be able to have a company in a year? Or what were the thoughts that were going through your mind? And like, how did you go through that?
It was a definite wake-up call for the business. To be honest, it wasn't as if I was scared, because the good thing is business shouldn't be that difficult. And it's just a bit of a wake-up call around, right, okay, let's refocus as a board on what are we here to do? What's our ambition as a business? What are the strategic priorities that we have as a business? And if what we're doing doesn't deliver against those strategic priorities, then we shouldn't do it. Because you can run around like a busy fool when you're the CEO of a business, doing things because you think they're good and it's making people happy and it's exciting and it's entrepreneurial and all the rest of it. But that's where you need to mature as a business. And that's what we did. At that moment, we suddenly became a really well-polished, well-run business as a whole, rather than a lifestyle business, which a lot of people will run. And there's nothing wrong with running a lifestyle business when you're 5 people or 10 people. When you're carrying cost base of millions and millions and millions of pounds, it's not a lifestyle anymore. It is a proper business that has people who are looking to invest in your business, and you need to show them a return on that investment. So there's a maturing as leaders that we needed to go through. So it wasn't panic stations. If we had carried on as we were, you're right, we probably wouldn't have been in business maybe 12 months down the line. But it never got to that, because we were just very quick to pivot, change the direction, focus on clients, get our cost base under control, strip out costs that wasn't adding value to clients. And that's all you're there to do. As a business, an agency, you're there to service your clients. Your clients are the ones that pay for everything that you do. And the minute you lose sight of that, then you're going to face troubles. And a lot of agencies do. A lot of agencies do go under because they just don't pivot quickly enough to, one, what's going on in the market, or two, what clients are demanding.
Could we zoom in a little bit more on that? Because I love how you described it, kind of moving from this lifestyle business or the passion project or whatever this is, where everyone is just loving what they do and hope the rest will take care of itself, to like, okay, we need like a very stable and sustainable business. So what were the differences? What actions did you make? And what was your thinking process? Did you, I don't know, sit down with a P&L and it's like, okay, what is this line? Let's remove this cost. Like, what was the process and what actions followed that process?
The thing is, when you set up a business and you're young, and we were in our 20s when we set Iris up, you only know what you know, and you learn on the job, because you're learning as you're creating and growing and acquiring. And yeah, most of those skills are are really valid and important. But you need to learn from people who have got greater levels of experience, have worked in other industries, have worked in bigger agencies. And that's what you're investing in. You're investing in better quality talent than we had within the business, just in certain areas. Because if we didn't have that, then we wouldn't have the right checks and balances in place, for example, from a commercial perspective. We were allowing more junior people to sign things off that a junior person shouldn't sign off, because the risk it was bringing to the business further down the line was far too great. So it was almost a maturing of the business. And that's the word that I use very carefully, because suddenly if you say an agency is maturing, people will think, oh, it's a bit boring now. And it's not about creativity and it's not about culture, which are the things I chatted about earlier. It wasn't any of those things. It was having the right format, checks, balances and processes in place, because we're a business turning over tens of millions of pounds at that stage. So you need to make sure that you have the right levels of scrutiny around certain investments. So that was one thing. So employing senior people and having a leadership team around you who could challenge and do things in a slightly different way. I think the other thing that forced us to do this was the fact that we started looking for external investment, because we wanted to go and acquire other businesses. And how do you go about doing that when you're running a business that you founded yourself and you're making good money? But if we wanted to spend 5 million or 10 million or whatever on a potential acquisition, how do we do that? So we got outside investment into the business. Outside investment need the right levels of detail and information flow and board meetings and board reports and everything that goes with that. So suddenly we were a lot more efficient. Suddenly we were a lot tighter in terms of the way the business, we knew where our money was being made. We knew what clients we were charging this margin for and what clients we were losing money on and what clients were sitting in the middle. So we were just a really well-run, slick machine. Whereas prior to that, going back to the point around our revenue growth, was hiding a pretty average business underneath that revenue growth. So a lot of things happened at the same time in terms of this happened and there was a case of we had too much cost and a client loss. And then this happened, we invested in better people, and then you get to a really good spot.
Brilliant. And I love how you say about when the revenue is growing, then you don't kind of think what's underneath. I've heard somewhere a metaphor that it's like when you have a lot of money or revenue, it's like a river that is just flowing nicely. And as soon as it kind of shrinks, you see everything that was at the bottom and all the, I don't know, ugly things that it was covering. So you're right, when suddenly challenges sometimes are good, and financial challenges even, because it suddenly makes you think, okay, what's underneath your business, what's underneath your organization, team, project that actually you need to think about a bit more carefully and thoughtfully.
Through tough times, you really understand how to run a business properly. And unless a business has had tough times, and I'd be amazed if any of the people who are on this call who are running their own business haven't gone through difficult times. So I'm not saying it wasn't stressful, it wasn't challenging, it wasn't something where you'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, right, I've got to do this and we've got to do that because this is really important. Because if you're a founder of a business, it means more to you than it does anybody else. And that's just a fact. And that's why it is difficult to step away from, when you're a founder, to step away from the thing that you've created and you've been so passionate about. But I know we'll go on to talk about it. It's an important thing that none of us feel almost like we've got a chain around us to a business. And you have to make sure that you don't feel as though that business and you are inextricably linked and constantly tied together, because that's a pretty dangerous place to be.
It totally resonates with me what you say about being a founder and sometimes not even thinking like, what am I part of the company, or am I doing something that I actually enjoy doing? And the reason why everyone starts a company because they want to do something they like and they want to enjoy the process. And it's sometimes so important to check in and see, like, is it still worth it? Am I still doing the right thing? And something that you mentioned at this point of your story is acquisitions and M&A and investment. Lovely, lovely part of an agency journey or company journey that I would like to zoom into for two reasons. One is taking investment. It's a big decision to make. And I'm sure a lot of people who run their own companies think about it at some point, or you get lots of email from private equity at all times that they would like to invest or buy shares of your company. So you kind of, these thoughts are always on the mind. Should I take, should I not? Why not? Like, what are pros and cons? And then kind of where to spend this money on. So my first question is around taking investment, because you obviously had a clear idea that the investment you're taking would be for acquiring purposes. You kind of had already, I suppose, a strategy for spending that money. Was there not enough money as your, why didn't you do it basically without external investment? Could you still acquire companies? Was there enough profit? Was it too risky to invest your own money or take a loan from the bank? I don't know. Why did you go for investment if you had this idea of acquiring companies?
So over the years within Iris, we had investment from, well, we had investment from the bank to start off with, and I've chatted about that. We had investment from a big American media business. And we thought that was really interesting in terms of them buying part of Iris, because they were huge in the States, and America is the land of opportunity when it comes to marketing services. It's just a huge market. And if you can crack America, then you're going to do fantastically well. The fact that that company owned television channels and magazines and social media channels felt like a really good strategic marriage, to be honest with you. So our creativity and skills around strategy coupled with the channels that they're going to market with felt really, really exciting. We found after about 2 to 2.5 years of that investment, it didn't really go in the direction that it wanted. They were really happy. The American company were really happy with the investment because they were getting good return on that. But if somebody is part owner of your business, if they're buying into your business and being given equity, my view was I wanted them to add value to our business. That was why we did it in the first place, because of their channels, because of their actions, because of the opportunities. And we were too small. They were a company turning over billions of dollars. And we were turning over at that stage, maybe 50 million, 60 million pounds. So it was something that we were just too small to really be a strategic focus for them. So that didn't really go in the way that we wanted. Because if someone owns part of your business, you want active involvement. That was something that I was really, really key on. So that was that. So then we swapped out that equity. And then that's when we got the equity from Chael, who basically bought Iris in the end. And Chael are part of Samsung. They're part of the Samsung group. And Chael are the marketing services division of Samsung. And again, it was a really interesting acquisition that we went through. And the reason we did it is because we thought Chael were a really interesting business. And it was almost like strength that they had in the East and we had in the West. And it was like they're around technology and Samsung, and we were around consumer brands and insight. So it almost felt like a really good strategic marriage in terms of that acquisition. And that is the ownership of Iris is with Chael now. So Iris is a fully owned business within the Chael network. But the going back to your original question around M&A, part of the acquisitions that we've done, or the part sales that we've done, have fueled that. It wasn't that difficult at the time to actually raise money through fairly standard terms with banks or equity funds or whatever. So it was never a difficult challenge for us to actually raise that money. And the thing about strategy and M&A strategy is you need to have one, because M&A is really easy. If you've got lots of money, it's a really easy thing to do. But getting good M&A is really difficult. And that's the whole point of due diligence and working out what hole are you trying to fill within your business. Are you just trying to buy lots of similar businesses to what you are already, which a lot of agencies will do? That was never, ever our plan, because if we were just wanting to be what we were, we had a very clear organic growth strategy around that, similar to what I've chatted about earlier. So any acquisition that Iris made in the years that I was leading the business was around value additive skills that would have taken the business probably 3 to 5 years to get even close to what we were acquiring. So Iris acquired, for example, a pricing strategy business, which you wouldn't necessarily expect an agency to buy. But if everybody talks about the 4 P's of marketing, the 1 P that everybody talks about but doesn't have any involvement in is pricing. And we realized that pricing is a massive opportunity within the world of marketing, because pricing strategists deal with CEOs, marketing agencies deal with CMOs. And we wanted to get on the top table. We wanted to be discussing business strategy with CEOs, and buying a pricing strategy business that would literally sit down with CEOs and say, if we can control your price, if we move that by 1% up in terms of what you're selling for, we can generate a 10% return on that in terms of your bottom line. Just absolutely fascinating. And there's no way you can build up that sort of skill organically. Iris bought an agency in Boston that was around data and analytics and CRM and ECRM. And again, that's a real specialist area. Iris bought an agency in London, which was around performance media and search and PPC and all of the specifics of digital media. So all of the acquisitions that Iris made were down to strategic plays that made the integrated offering that the business now has so much stronger, because clients were saying, can you do our search and performance media for us? Can you develop this for us? Can you do more data and CRM work? And it was like, we can, but we're now attracting clients of the scale that you need to go and acquire those businesses to be able to. You can't just pretend, and you can't just bring in one or two people and hope to grow that organically. There needs to be a clear acquisition. So the one thing that I would say to anybody that's looking at acquisition is, don't rush it. Have a very clear view of what you are after. And it might change slightly, but you need to stay true to that, because otherwise you're just going to be teed up with great opportunities that you think you can make that much better. But if they're not making the whole great and the sum of the parts, then there's no point in doing it.
It felt like you were so ahead of the times in terms of what will happen to the industry, like you said, anything from CRMs to kind of social media or PPC agencies, and kind of pricing and marrying business and creativity together. These are conversations that have been happening recently and more happen in a creative industry, but you had the conviction and vision as a marketing agency, as an advertising agency, to actually go into those territories quite early on. So I wonder, how did you make those decisions? And was it, again, client driven, that clients were asking for this, so they were asking so many times that you had a decision whether to grow it internally or acquire? Or was it kind of researching, like, what's going on in the industry, where should we go, like, how, why did you pick those areas and how did you decide on those?
There's probably three or four things as to why we went in the direction that we went with our M&A. So part of it was down to clients. So clients would ask us for things. And if one client was asking us, we'd probably say, okay, yeah, we don't do that at the moment. Suddenly three or four clients are asking, actually, there's something going on here that creates an interest. If you're that late to suddenly start acquiring after clients are asking you, there tends to be quite a considerable multiple on the value of a business that you're looking to buy, because the market is almost telling you that's what you need to do. The way that you can get really good deals through M&A is exactly as you said, being ahead of the market, trying to think about what clients might need in 18 months to 24 months rather than what they need now. Because if you can do that, the multiples that you have to pay for those businesses are considerably lower. The length of earnouts and everything that goes with that can be done on your terms rather than, and you look at something like performance media, digital performance media, the multiples that agencies are operating at now compared to when we bought the performance media business that we bought are probably two or three times higher, just because that's the way the market is going. Because all clients now are saying, I need value for digital investment. If I'm not getting that, then I'm not going to be working with you. So everybody's buying performance media businesses. It was partly down to clients asking us, but that would tend to be a little bit late in the day and you're spending too much money on those things. Partly down to what we found interesting as individuals. You can't ever forget that sometimes you need to be, as a founder, you can be sometimes a bit self-indulgent. You can do things because you are excited by them. So a pricing strategy business, I was really excited about. I didn't know whether it would work in the way that I thought it would with the clients that we had. We did the due diligence, but it's why we get out of bed. It's why we set up the businesses that we're working within in the first place, is to do things that are slightly risky, that create that feeling of frustrated ambition that I had before. I'm frustrated because we're not good enough at that and we need to be better at that. And M&A can deliver that in breakneck speed, but you get it wrong and it can sink your business as well. And some people, and again, I've spoken to a number of CEOs who have a totally opportunistic view of M&A. So they don't have a strategy and they just talk to a lot of M&A advisors and they say, if anything comes on the market that you think is very reasonably priced and pretty well placed, then talk to me. And then they'll just go on an acquisition spree. They're less worried about what the business does and more worried about how that can deliver a return on the investment. That was never really my approach. I always had a clear strategic view and employed people who could challenge that and say, actually, we think that's dead in the water. That's not going to be the way the business should be going moving forward. So I'm certainly not saying that every time that I said we should acquire this, that we went ahead and did that, because I had super smart leaders in the business who would be far closer to some of these things.
Thank you for that advice. And you're so right. It's you need to be so strategic in these big decisions, because they can literally sink your company. Can you give a kind of a rough idea? And I know it's probably a very difficult question, but in terms of the companies you acquired or what you've seen creates a successful acquisition, is there any, first of all, at what point? So for example, you shouldn't acquire companies before you're a certain size or certain revenue or certain stability. And also, what should be the ratio between who you're acquiring, whether it is, again, in terms of size, it could be in terms of revenue, maturity of the company. So how to understand which companies you actually should go for and acquire, in terms of like, are they too big, are they too small, good enough?
You're probably going to be disappointed with my answer, because I can't really answer it. Because if I look at the acquisitions that I made whilst I was at Iris, some of those companies were 9-10 people, some of them were 70 people. And I don't think it really comes down to the scale or the maturity or how long they've been operating or their profit margin or any of those things. Obviously, in a due diligence program, you will look at a lot of those things. I always viewed it sort of against two different criteria. One was, do I feel as though we, as Iris, can make this business that much better? So do I feel as though they can integrate well within our offering? Do I feel as though clients will be interested in actually buying the skills that they have? So there's almost like an operational and a strategic view around, will they add value? Will they make our offering that much stronger? Will it be interesting to the market? And it was always a bit of an intangible test for me. Could I see my competitors thinking, that's quite odd. Why have they done that? Why have they bought a pricing? Why have they bought a CRM business in Boston? Why have they done this, a B2B business in Munich? And it was always being two or three steps ahead of everybody else in the market. So that was the first thing. The second thing, and I'd say this is even more important, was down to the cultural engagement between what we were doing at Iris and what the individuals wanted to do within that business. So do they have the frustrated ambition that I have and the rest of the leaders have within Iris? If they don't, it's going to fall flat on its face immediately. So an interesting story. I went out to Germany. I was looking to buy an agency in Germany. There was an M&A advisor that teed up 10 different meetings with various sized agencies from 20 people up to 120 people. So met a lot of these businesses. And one of the things that I would always do, I talk about Iris, I would talk about our ambition, I talk about growth, I would talk about how we could help their business grow. And I would say in 7 of the 10 meetings, I got a really, really poor response from that presentation, which was almost sort of put me back a little bit, because every time I'd given that presentation over the years to potential M&As, they're like, brilliant, really excited. So you've got that client, and you could spin that in there and we could grow. And a lot of the guys in the German businesses that we were looking to buy were sort of sitting there with their arms folded and said, okay, that. And I said, well, you don't seem to be that excited or engaged in. And they're like, well, we don't really want to grow. We're really happy being the size that we are, because there is certain legislation in Germany, whereas if you go above a certain size of business, it brings with it a huge amount of red tape and legal challenges around whether you recruit or let go people go and all the rest of it. And these people were totally running lifestyle agencies where they had taken it to where they wanted to take it and just wanted to take some money off the table. And that was so far away from what we wanted. It was quite a depressing journey, I would say, in the 5 or 6 days that I was there, because I was meeting so many people that just weren't interested in what I found really, really important, which was growth and ambition and synergies and efficiencies and everything else. So I guess that is quite an interesting insight, where it's got to add value to your business, not from a commercial perspective, from an operational and from an output perspective. And there's got to be cultural depth and synergies across the two. So if you can get those two things right, I think M&A will absolutely fly within any business.
following from that story of kind of meeting the founders or leadership teams, they were not excited. Was there any sort of trend or the typical setup? Would you prefer to acquire companies that founders still wanted to run the companies and keep growing the companies? And was, for example, someone who just wanted to sell off the company and leave a no-no for you? What was the good set up for you in terms of the founder of the business who runs the company in your acquisitions?
Yeah, I was never totally wedded to an individual or a founder of a business in terms of, well, he or she is amazing. And therefore, if we don't have him or her to actually run the business, then it's going to be a problem. Obviously, most of the negotiation would go on with the founder. But a lot of the time when a company is sold, the founder is doing it for a reason. The founder may have either run out of ideas as far as where the business was going to go moving forward, or the founder wanted to realize some value from a business that they had been growing for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody should realize some value from a business that they've invested their time in. So as part of the due diligence, I would always spend probably as much, if not more, time with the next layer down. So the people who made up the board, strategy director, creative director, client service director, finance director, and then one layer down from that. Because sometimes if you buy a founder, you're buying one person. And that's a pretty dangerous place to be. What you need to buy is a culture, a client, a leadership team. That's where the value really, really sits, because the leadership team have probably been sitting there for a number of years, sometimes getting frustrated the fact that the founder's never going to go anywhere. And there's a glass ceiling. And we all need to be mindful of that as a founder of a business. Sometimes you do need to step away to allow other people to really shine and perhaps run the business in a different way that may be far better than the way that you've been running it.
Love it. And we'll talk about stepping away in a second, because that's another exciting conversation. But would love to wrap up this kind of block of the growth. So what happened from that moment of you starting to acquire agencies to this, let's say, the mark of 1,000 people? Was it generally through like another linear path for growth and acquisitions? So then you kind of started growing, or was there another bump in that journey before the final, or at least current destination?
I think anybody that works in the world of agencies, advertising agencies, marketing agencies, will know that probably every week there is a bump or two. And nothing ever goes fantastically well. And the famous saying, isn't there, that as a CEO of an agency, you're only 3 phone calls away from closing the door, which is if your top 3 clients phone you up and say, right, we're going to stop working with you, then it tends to be that the top 3 clients will generate 60 to 80% of any agency's revenue. So it's a pretty fragile business case that you have as an agency person. So yeah, I'm not saying that everything was incredibly successful, although we had far more wins than losses. But you never keep all of your clients. That would be success to me, that you never lose a client and you continue to grow and you win awards. But that's just the reality of that doesn't happen. But when it comes to sort of quite seismic knocks to Iris, no, there hasn't really been any. 10, so probably 13, 14 years ago, when I was explaining what was going on as far as cost was out of control with the revenue and we spent too much money, that was the wake-up call for the business. And then since then, the business continued to grow year on year on year. Sometimes it grew through acquisition, sometimes it grew through organic growth. And for me, I think it's dangerous if a business has to rely on acquisition to show growth. That's quite dangerous. I think you need to be able to strip acquisition out and still show growth organically. And then the acquisition sort of shows more exponential growth, which I think is quite important. So no, there's, as I said, every week there was a learning, every week there was something that didn't quite go to plan, but that's the industry that we all decided to get into. And what a fantastic industry it is. I've got the utmost sort of respect and fond memories of my 25 years in the world of advertising. I genuinely loved it.
Brilliant. Well, then let's talk about the next chapter of your journey, which is, again, very unusual and very interesting. So not just the fact that you stepped down as a CEO of the company, as a founder, you left the company, but also you decided to join another company that you didn't fund and become a CEO. So talk to us a little bit about that transition. Why did you decide to do it and how did it feel as a process?
It was an interesting process because we went through the sale to Chael and that completed in 2020. And at that time, I was thinking long and hard about what I wanted to do. Did I want to carry on running Iris? Did I want to take more of a non-executive type of role within Iris and let somebody else step in and lead the business? Did I want to set up another agency completely from scratch? Or did I want to be an investor in other people's businesses? There were sort of so many options that I had. And that was quite strange because prior to that, I'd always been like literally 150% focused on Iris. I would never even consider anything beyond Iris because it was something that I had helped create alongside the co-founders of the business that are still great friends of mine now. It was interesting. And there were two things that made me really sit up and think about this. And none of them are that seismic on their own. But the first was I was turning into the guy that you don't necessarily want to talk to in the pub about your work. You know, you go to the pub on a Friday night and everybody's like, how's work? And there's always one in the group that's like, oh, it's a bloody nightmare. It's a nightmare at the moment. I'm really not happy about that. And that's annoying me. And I could see myself doing it. And I was thinking, this is not what I'm all about because I've always been so positive and upbeat and excited and talking about, we're doing this for Adidas at the moment and we're doing this. And I flew out here and went to Singapore office and did that. And I just wasn't getting that feeling. And it's a weird thing that you just don't get. If you're not getting the feeling, then you have to do something about it, whether you founded the business or not. Because I was one of a group of co-founders of Iris. We sold the business to Chael. I've got no regrets about selling the business to Chael. Chael are an incredible business, hugely successful. That sort of that part of the story is done. But just because I sold the business and I was a founder of the business or a co-founder of the business doesn't mean that I have to be with that business forever. Because I didn't want to get to the stage in 10 years' time where I look back and think, I'm so proud of what I achieved at Iris, but I've never done anything else. I've always worked in one company for 23 years, and prior to that, a big network for a chunk of time as well. And then the second thing was my wife said to me, she said, you just don't act in the same way about work. You don't have that glint in your eye. And these are quite intangible, aren't they? In terms of, do you want to be the guy down the pub who's moaning about work? And your wife tells you, you don't have that glint in your eye when you're talking about the things that you're doing. And it was those two things that happened together that made me think, I owe it to myself and my family to just do something else. And to be honest with you, more myself than anybody else, because I didn't want to just not try something completely different. The opportunity came up sort of very, very quickly. Almost I was headhunted and someone said, all right, okay. And the most obvious thing would have been for me to go and either set up another network of agencies or go and work within a big group. This came up and it was just a fascinating opportunity. I've always been fascinated by the world of computer games. It's not that I play computer games every weekend, but I can really respect the fact that it's about insight and strategy and storytelling and bringing to life something that creates that emotional connection with a player or a gamer. In the same way that advertising does the same thing. But the problem with advertising is more and more people are actively rejecting advertising, that they don't want it. They're actively signing out of getting any form of communication. So one, you're almost pushing water uphill. The other one, you're pushing on an open door, to sort of bring two mixed analogies there. But with computer games, you've got people that love your games, that literally will do whatever they can to get little updates or insights or play the game and talk about it. And I've just found it fascinating. And somebody told me, and this is a fact, which I found like incredible, that the size of the computer games industry is bigger than the entire film industry and the entire music industry combined. So it shows the scale of money that is invested in computer games when you think of every single movie in the world and every album or single or record that is ever sold in a year. Computer games is considerably bigger than that. It's a fascinating marketplace. I'm learning so much about a different industry, but it's not that different to advertising. Like genuinely, people say, what a massive step from this to this. I haven't viewed it like that at all. And I'm 6 months in And I'm really happy. I'm learning loads. It's super exciting. And that's sort of pretty much about all I can say about it, really, in terms of where I am with it.
Love it, love it. And I can see your excitement. So definitely your wife was right about you finding the new challenge. You definitely have a spark in your eyes. So that means you made definitely a right decision. We will be taking questions from all of you now. So please start typing any of the questions you have in the chat while we will start with some of the pre-submitted questions that people really wanted to know. I love this question from David. Would you start an agency in 2024, especially from financial point of view? I would even expand it in general. If you were starting the agency now, anything you would do differently? I think it's what you see in the industry. How would you approach it?
The thing that I can observe about the industry is there's an oversupply of agencies. So there are thousands of agencies, small ones, independent ones, big network ones, boutique ones, ones that are claiming that they're anti-advertising and then they do advertise. So it's full of the world of marketing and ad agencies is complicated. Clients want a simple existence. And now this is quite interesting because I've gone from being an agency person to being, in effect, a client who works with agencies. I can see the role that agencies play within the world of a CMO or a CEO of a client. And when you're in the agency, you think you're the most important part of that client's life, and you're not, because marketing and the creative output from a marketing agency is a relatively small sliver of a million things that are going on within any given business. So the advice that I would give is you need to have a really clear proposition, and you need to be standing out or doing something slightly different from anybody else. And that's easily said, isn't it? Because there are so many agencies out there. So how can you stand out? But you have to think about that. You also have to think that clients buy strategy more than anything else. That is the thing they are most interested in, because that is the thing that will shift the dial in terms of whether it's a share price or whether it's a sales figure or whatever it is. It's the strategy that opens up that opportunity. The strategy and the creativity combined is where the magic happens. And that's an incredibly powerful thing. But clients, more than anything else, will buy strategic insight. Clients that really understand, or agencies that really understand what is going on in their category and can open up doors of doing that. And that may be through a creative execution. It may not be through a creative execution, because strategy moves you further up the food chain, and it gives you access to the C-suite. And it's only when you have access to the C-suite are you truly indispensable to your client. Because if you're further down the list of, and you're dealing with a marketing manager and you're doing some nice design work for, or whatever, there's thousands of agencies that can do that. And a new CMO will say, well, get rid of that agency and we'll go. And then suddenly you're on the back foot. So I would say strategy is key and should be at the heart of anything. Management consultancy is quite an interesting area as well. And managing the skills of managing consultancy, brand strategy, and creativity. And if there's a Venn diagram, sort of the sweet spot between those three things, it is a really powerful place to start operating. But I think the thing is, if you've got ambitious people who want to found that business with you, pay yourself a really low salary for a 6 to 12 month period, as founders have to do, or don't pay yourself at all, as founders have to do, and just give it a go. Because back to the point I said earlier, you don't need hundreds of millions of pounds worth of funds to be able to set up an agency. You just need a few people who are buying into it.
I love what you mentioned about the kind of having access to CEO and actually making a difference. I 100% agree with you, being on both sides of the table, that the creative work is incredible and always inspiring, but having that business insight and understanding what you as an agency, as individual, a freelancer, whoever you are, make for a business is what matters to the decision makers. So that strategic piece of whether it is how to make more money, go into new territories, whatever that is, and you can actually explain how to make it happen and deliver what you said will happen. That's magical. AI and Max is asking, what do you think will be the future of creative consultancy services, especially now with the AI revolution happening as we speak?
I think whatever industry you work in, AI is is a question that people are asking. They're certainly asking a lot about AI in the world of computer games, because obviously you have a standard way of making computer games. You have developers, you have creative people that do that. And I think you can view AI in one of two ways. To be honest with you, I'm an optimist when it comes to the role that AI can play. But it goes back to what I was saying earlier. If you're a business or an agency or a consultancy that is developing strategic insight that is really shifting the dial of the value of a particular business, then you will fly. And you can use AI to just shortcut some of the things that have taken people days or weeks or months to actually produce. So I think if you view AI in that sense, and that might be a very simplistic view of AI, but I still haven't seen AI develop the depth of insight and strategy that a human can. I just haven't seen it. I haven't seen any proof that, yeah, they might occasionally, AI may come up with, oh, actually, this is the way forward or that's the way forward. But I say 8 times out of 10 at the moment, what I see is that doesn't quite make sense, or that doesn't quite deliver against what the client has asked for. So I'm not overly, if I was running an agency in the way that I was, I would be embracing AI in terms of what can we allow it to bring from a creative executional perspective, a design perspective, because that's where it can be invaluable. I look at pitch presentations now compared to 10 years ago, and they're just incredible because agencies can tap into the use of AI to actually bring those things to life. It can be used for copy in a way that can take it to a certain level, but it's never going to feel as fine-tuned or finessed as a human. It may well get there in the next 3 to 5 years, but I genuinely don't think it is now. But it almost heightens what I was saying earlier around hired value, strategy, insight, and C-suite. If you can do that, then the agency or the business or the consultancy will do fantastically well.
Brilliant. Thank you for answering this. Benedetta is asking, how would Iris qualify clients in the early days? What kind of criteria would the team use in determining who to work with?
In the very early days, the criteria was, do they have any money? It was genuinely as simple as that. Obviously, there were certain moral things that we would never work with tobacco brands, that there'll be certain parts of the world that we would say we don't agree with the human right challenges of those countries. So we were always very strong when it came to certain things. But when you start a business, you don't have the luxury to be able to say, oh no, we're not going to do that because it doesn't feel as though it feels a bit down and dirty for what we're all about. You scrap around. One of the co-founders of Iris, the person who worked in his local town, whose parents ran the Chinese restaurant in the local town, needed a website building for £5,000, and we built the website. We worked with a local amusement arcade who was paying £2,000 a month to do all the partnership marketing to try and deliver footfall to the amusement park in the local area. So there was nothing too small for us to want to work on. But that did change, and you do get to a stage after a couple of years where you have confidence in what you're worth, and you know that anything that you're doing has to deliver against a few criteria. It has to make you feel proud to work on it. It has to be something that you would say you quite happily put in your credentials presentation, say, I'm proud to be doing this because it's taken the business that much further. And they have to pay the right amount of money. So it almost goes back to this triangle of truth. Is the product going to be good? Is it going to make our people happy? And are they going to pay? And if you can deliver against those three, then it would usually be a yes. As we grew, as Iris grew, we became far more sophisticated around, do we have a chance of winning it? Who are we pitching against? How do we feel as though we could grow this client into be a cornerstone of client rather than just a peripheral tactical client? But to start off with, the criteria was, do we feel as though they're going to pay for what we're doing? And do we feel as though we feel comfortable doing it from a moral perspective? And if the answer was yes, then we would get on and do it.
Love it. Thank you so much for answering. And I have a follow-up question from that, because you already talked a lot about not taking kind of eye of the ball of like looking after clients and how important it is, obviously, to look after your team and culture, but also look after clients. What does that actually mean in practice? We had lots of questions actually about client engagement and kind of all of this. What are the best practices? How to have a retainer with a client. So how would you keep the clients? What are the things on the very practical day-to-day, taking them for drinks and dinners, typical advertising industry, or like any other things that actually will keep them as a client and maybe grow them as a client as well?
The best thing that I ever learned relatively soon in my career was the only way to really understand what is going to make that client-agency relationship sticky is to truly understand what the client's personal objectives are. And that sounds quite a strange thing to do, but whenever I would pitch on a client's business, if we were to win that client's business, I would take the CMO out for a sandwich, a dinner, a glass of wine or whatever. And I would say, right, I'd be really interested to know what your KPIs are. What are your objectives by the CEO of the business? And he or she would say to me, well, actually, one of my objectives is to win an award. I've got to win a tier one award, whether that's a DNAD or a Cannes Lion or whatever. And I'm like, okay, I understand that. So now I know that's one of the things that we have to do. Another one might be that I have to make sure that we have 85% awareness or people within the population that are saying positive things about, okay, brilliant. So we need to do a job around making sure that we've got positivity running through everything that we're, et cetera, et cetera. So finding out what a client's personal objectives are and what they want as an individual, because some clients have got an ego the size of a house. So if they've got a big ego, we need to make sure we're putting them on stages, talking or doing podcasts or doing this. By the way, I'm not saying that people that do podcasts have big egos, by the way, because I don't really, but you know what I mean. But it would suddenly be part of our marketing plan of retention for that client to deliver what we think is required of them. So that would be one part of it. And I think that's something that not many agencies or not many CEOs or MDs or even business directors will do. So that's one piece of advice. I think something else that's really, really important is not taking any client for granted and making sure you've got enough time with them to actually take that step back and review progress of the relationship, and not just the most senior person, because what tends to happen, what I found, clients are one at the top. So it's usually the CMO who will decide the agency that he or she wants to work with, but clients will be lost at the bottom. And what I mean by that, it will be the marketing manager who gets fed up with the agency delivering things late, or the marketing executive who doesn't get a purchase order in time to be able to, or they send something at 9 o'clock on a Friday night saying we need approval by first thing on Monday morning, so the weekend is taken out. So as I said, agencies are one at the top and lost at the bottom, because murmurings amongst the bottom most junior people then filter up to the CMO, and the CMO has to act on behalf of his or her team. So the minute you lose sight of that, so therefore doing some form of program, I would say every 6 months, where you ask a number of questions to all of those clients around, are we delivering against this? Are we delivering value for money? Are we value add? Are we giving you things that you're not expecting? And then you take that, you play it back to the client with some form of recommendation on what you're going to do to change it. So there's nothing groundbreaking in what I've said there, but one, find out what the client's objectives are, and two, don't take them for granted by talking about the senior, the middleweight and the junior people and listening to their points of view.
Wow, that is a fantastic advice, and could not agree more that I think in the creative world, everyone puts so much effort into the pitching, into the winning the client, into these big ideas, and sometimes forget about the operational side that makes clients like you or not and rebook your, give you a retainer or not at the end of the day. So I think I'm so glad you highlighted that. And that takes a lot of effort and reflection and actually asking the clients whether they liked working with you or not and having an honest conversation. I feel like this needs a part two, because we have so many questions and so many interesting discussions, and we have only a few minutes left, so unfortunately we'll have to just maybe ask one last question before we wrap up. There is a big one here. Suzanne is asking, do you think creative pitches should be paid for ones that require a lot of work and resource? So if a potential client is asking for pitches from several agencies and you are wanting to win the business,
it's one of the biggest frustrations, I think, and one of the things that is so wrong about the world of marketing and advertising agencies, because there's very few, if any, other industries in the world where you will work for a month, 6 weeks, spend literally hundreds of thousands of pounds, dollars, euros on a pitch, And then you just get a phone call. So I'm sorry, you didn't get that. And it's almost like, I just can't believe that that has just happened. Do I think pitches should be paid for? Not necessarily, because I think even if they give you £5,000 or £10,000, it's a drop in the ocean compared to what you're going to invest in that particular pitch. Do I think the pitch process is fundamentally flawed? Yes, I do. Because what the pitch process provides, it's almost like a beauty parade where you've got lots of beautiful agencies that are rolling out the red carpet and making clients feel special, and the pitching the big idea, here's the big idea, the strategy and the execution. What we found at Iris was happening more and more, and I think this is a really powerful step forward with the industry, is more and more clients were saying, I don't want to do an official pitch in terms of you do the big show and tell. We want to do it as a process of a workshop or a number of workshops during the pitch process. So we get to work with you. We get to see how you think, how you act. We want to work with the people that we're actually going to be buying the ideas from and working with moving forward. So suddenly you go from a cultural blind buy, which is what a pitch is, because yeah, you might have met them two or three times, but you're going to meet the CEO. You'll probably meet the creative director. You'll probably meet the strategy director, who will all be super polished in terms of the way they present. But then you're working with the account director and the account manager and the junior creative, and they may not be up to the standard that they've had. So I think pitches are fundamentally flawed. There have been so many discussions within the industry around, do all agencies boycott pitches and say, we're not going to do it anymore? The problem we face is, if 80% of the agencies say we're not going to pitch, there will be 20% that do, because it's such a cutthroat industry where people are desperate for new business, and you will do whatever you have to do, which is why agencies spend so much time, effort and money on a pitch. But the best intermediaries now are realizing that the best way of really finding out a marriage between an agency and a client is through workshops and spending time and watching them think and act and developing ideas together, rather than just giving a brief and come back in 6 weeks' time and give us a response.
Rian, and I can see that it resonates with everyone listening and everyone agrees with your thinking process. It actually links to something that we discussed in our previous episode of this podcast with Abby Freeman, who talked the same about hiring process, that they do workshopping with potential candidates, and instead of asking questions, actually do a little piece of work and workshop together and see how they behave in a real scenario, because you're right, that's the only way to know what the person is like.
Totally right. Totally right. It's a problem, and I can't see it changing in the short term. But as an industry, you guys, and I say you guys because I don't work in the world of advertising and marketing anymore, but it has to change. It's just not fair, and it just feels totally wrong for what we're trying to do as an industry.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for challenging us. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. I have one last question left for you, Steve, for the listeners who know our podcast, probably know what's coming next, which is a big one. Steve, if you could change one thing in the world, what would it be?
It's such a good question, because my mind initially jumps into, I could go so macro and come up with something, peace on earth. And you look at all the problems that are happening in the world at the moment that just make you so thoroughly depressed on a day-to-day basis when you watch the news at 10 o'clock at night. And that's almost a case of, well, I could say that and it would be the expected answer. But for me, it's almost something a little bit more basic than that, which is, and it's something that I've, well, there's two things really. There's two bits of advice that people have given me over the years. And I don't even think this is answering your question, but I'm going to go with it anyway, because it's a better answer than saying I'd like peace on earth forever or something like that. And one of those things is really, really obvious, but it is treat other people the way you'd like to be treated yourself, which sounds such a basic thing to say. But at times when you're running a business or you're running at a million miles an hour, you might not do that. And I think you need to check yourself, because everybody in your business or everybody that we're working with, 90% of the time, are good people who are trying their best. So suddenly, just because you're forming a very senior position within a company, just treat other people with respect, whether they're the most junior person or the most senior person. And that's done me quite well in terms of my career. And then somebody else said to me once, and it's, again, a really, really powerful thing, very easy to say, but very difficult to do, is Nobody on their deathbed has said, I wish I'd worked a little bit harder in my career. Everybody on their deathbed said, I wish I'd spent the time with the people I really love and respect and value in life. And that's quite an interesting thing to say when you're a founder, when you do, suddenly you've got tunnel vision, you're running so hard at things and there's nothing more important than the business that you're, but you need somebody or you need to check yourself around, actually, it is business and it's really, really important. But there are things that are equally as important and you need to make sure you get that right balance. Because if you don't, you won't be a very good leader. If you give everything to your business and don't have anything outside of it, I feel as though you end up being a little bit constricted by it. And also you can get bitter. And I've seen CEOs and leaders become bitter about the thing that they feel as though is dragging them through their life rather than them having a life outside of that. So as I said, I don't think it's answered your question particularly well, but it's just two bits of advice that I like to think about and communicate if I can.
I think this is a wonderful answer, Stephen. Thank you so much for sharing. I always feel like whatever I ask you, the answer is so much better and so much deeper and so much more exciting and thoughtful. So thank you for sharing all of your experience and advice. And it's seriously incredible and inspiring what you've built, but also how you stayed such a great human throughout this. And hearing about how you think and how you approached everything only makes me even more optimistic about the fact that you can run a big company, you can grow something and create something successful and still be a wonderful human being and a friend and a mentor and a good person. So thank you for sharing this with us and sharing so many practical things that I feel like a lot of us can definitely apply in whatever stage of the company we're at. So thank you for this.
No, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. And obviously I didn't know what questions were going to be asked. And hopefully it's been of value to the people that are on this call, because obviously all of them are either running businesses, want to run businesses, are senior or working within businesses. So it's been a pleasure to do it. I've really enjoyed it. So hopefully people can take some insight from it.
Sure. Thank you so much, Steve. And please do check out Team 17, the new company, the amazing gaming company that Steve is running. Anywhere people should find you, follow you?
Yeah, on LinkedIn is the best bet. So yeah, please feel free just to drop us a note on LinkedIn and good luck with everything. I genuinely mean it.
Thanks again. And thanks everyone for joining and staying until the end, and loved everyone's questions and engagement and smiles and just being present together in this lovely evening, wherever you are, maybe morning for you. Thanks again. And as always, until next time, bye.
Thanks guys. Bye.